A podcast of the cinema. And happy Thanksgiving.
This is a Linoleum Knife and a Half.
Yes.
We're not, it's not a, normally we run between an hour and 90 minutes.
Right.
We're going to cut it at an hour today. Here's why. This isn't even the normal episode.
No.
This is a
fill-in.
This is a we need to catch up episode. We've got movies that we need to catch up on. We've got correspondence from y'all that we need to catch up on.
And we will completely catch up on neither.
Correct. Not in this hour.
No.
You're going to get 60 minutes as a stopgap pre-Thanksgiving bonus episode just because we want to push things forward and try to catch up on everything. Because I feel like we're falling behind. And I don't like that.
It's mainly you.
I am falling behind, and I don't like that.
So this weekend, we'll do our regular show, and we will cover all of the big Thanksgiving week releases, like
and
Moana.
Probably one of those, or two of those here today, right now. Who knows what we're going to do?
Okay, well, they'll know from the pod title. Going into this, I thought we weren't doing that, but fine, whatever.
We're going to do whatever we can do in an hour.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, but
I would also like us to get through some letters. So,
yeah, that's part of it too.
All right. Well, then, should we cut the chit chat and the claptrap?
Why don't you introduce your face?
I'm Alonzo Duraldi, film reviews editor for The Wrap and film critic for What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
I'm Dave White, also a film critic, also for The Wrap, but not nearly as much as you are for The Wrap.
No.
I'm a special person. At The Wrap. I come in when I come in as needed.
You're in the special people's club.
Yeah. And all the ways that you can be a special person. That's what I am. If you're listening accidentally for the first time to this halfsies episode.
Yeah, this is sort of an appendix episode.
We are two film critics who are also married to each other.
Correct.
This is recorded at our dining room table.
Where I'm currently smelling simmering turkey neck.
Yes.
Is that going to be like a gravy?
It is. What? Look over there to your left. To your left.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that jar that's full of it already?
Uh-huh.
That's what's up.
The stock for gravy?
It is the turkey neck and the giblets.
Hmm.
All boiled up. And what that partially becomes is stuff to add to our cheating gravy.
Why is it cheating gravy?
It's cheating because we're
You're
not
cheating gravy.
I'm not totally making gravy from scratch.
Oh well, no one does.
Yeah, people do all the time.
Yeah, they're crazy.
But you and I have learned over the years that we sure do love that Williams Sonoma turkey gravy base.
Mm-hmm.
So we buy a jar of it each October,
uh-huh.
And we use it. And so what happens is you put that stuff in with the turkey gravy base, and then some some flour and some milk or whatever, and then it becomes that nice turkey gravy.
There's some old like one of those flashy like 50s or 60s wrestlers guys like Fred Blassie or somebody
okay.
had some song where he kept referring to people as turkey necks.
Well, a turkey neck is a long, skinny neck.
Right.
And if you were a big wrestler, dude, you have a giant, Dave White neck.
Or no neck at all if you're Tor Johnson.
Yeah. Right. I've never quite understood the expression no neck. Because what you're really saying is the person has a whole lot of neck.
Well, so much neck that it's hard to tell where the jaw ends
Correct.
And the neck begins.
Correct.
It's the above the shoulder cankle.
That's what I have.
You have a head cankle.
I have a head cankle. My neck is so big. Come on, say it.
How big is it?
Yeah. That I have to have shirts made. Like if I want to get a shirt for a necktie,
yeah,
it has to be made. Used to be 20. My neck size used to be 20. Now it's 19 because I'm skinny.
Reducing. Well, to quote El DeBarge on that classic episode of The Facts of Life, you wear it well.
Oh, I know. I know. What was I talking about? Oh, that's the turkey neck.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So as you could see when you walked in from What the Flick today, you looked inside the refrigerator, and there is the turkey all ready to go into the oven tomorrow morning.
Yes, all trussed. Now, did you dump OJ all over it?
I will explain what I've done.
Please.
I'm sure the listeners are very excited, and eventually they know we will get to the movie.
Yes.
Movies. People call me a foodie, which I don't like, because I think you sound like a pretentious butthole.
Yeah.
If you refer to yourself as a foodie, watch out.
Yeah. Like, I've never heard you use the word reduction when talking about anything you've ever cooked.
Right. Even though I love to cook and I do it all the time, and I love to bake and I do it all the time, and I'm half-assed okay at it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the word foodie is ridiculous. And when people call me it, I just say, no. I'm a gorger.
I'm an Edie.
Yeah. But anyway, the food people are really big on Thanksgiving turkeys being fresh from the local farm, you know, like.
And if it didn't cost $10,000, I'm sure we'd do that.
Do you know how much that chicken, you know how much that turkey costs, that fresh one from the local farm?
Like $10 a pound or something.
It's like 80, 90 bucks, depending on or even more, depending on how big it needs to be.
Right.
That's crazy.
Butterball, 99 cents a pound at Target.
I grew up on frozen butterball. I'm sure it's not even really a turkey anymore. But that's what I'm used to. And I have learned over the years how to make that thing sing.
It's true.
Plus, it's, as you said, 99 cents a pound at Target.
If I ever ate a non-butterball turkey,
you would wonder what it would be.
It would be gamey somehow.
It would taste weird.
What is this, quail?
And it's funny because, you know, I'm so picky about everything else. Like, I make my own cranberry sauce and, you know, I make my own chicken stock. I got veal bones the other week. I'm going to make a veal stock to make the French onion soup. Like,
oh, I can't wait.
I'm the person who goes around the outside to get it done.
Right.
In a way that
good stuff.
Lots of folks don't. I want it to be really good.
Yeah.
Except I love that butterball turkey. So. Same way that I love stovetop stuffing, even though I have weaned myself off of stovetop stuffing because I realize that is a bridge too far. that is not even. I mean, it tastes so good.
It's salty carbs.
I grew up on that as a child too, but now I realize that when you make your own stuffing, it's better than stovetop.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I had to fight the fight of stuffing in my house.
What? Why?
Because my parents were immigrants and did not get it, and my father would always disparagingly refer to it as serrín, which is Spanish for sawdust.
Sawdust, right.
But it was like, no, stuffing, it's really good.
Well, in England at Christmas time, they have this thing called bread sauce. Do you remember the year I made it out of the Nigella Christmas cookbook and how delicious it was, but kind of disgusting?
A bit, yes.
Yeah. So I thaw out the butterball. It takes a week to thaw out the butterball because I always buy like a 20-pound turkey. And then I do the Martha Stewart thing to it. I just stuff it full of herbs.
So you don't pour orange juice all over the cavity?
Well, yes, I do that.
That was my question.
Okay, you pull it out of the plastic wrapper. Mm-hmm. You run cold water over it and inside it to rinse it out.
Take out all the bags of giblets.
Out the neck and all that stuff. And then you pour like 2 cups of orange juice all over the skin and inside. And that kind of freshens it up. stuff it with all the herbs.
Yes.
The four big Simon and Garfunkels.
Mm-hmm.
Parsley, sage, thyme, rosemary.
And an onion.
Like half an onion.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the cavity. Then you take a big giant glob of softened butter and you work that under the skin mm-hmm. of the breast. And then you just cover it all in salt and pepper, and then it goes in the oven.
Yeah, you don't have to baste.
High heat. No, you don't even, I don't baste a thing. I do it at like 450 degrees mm-hmm. the whole way through. I don't like the low and slow turkey. I like the high heat because it gets it all crispy on the outside and cooks it up nice on the inside.
It's really great.
And it takes like 3 hours on a giant bird or a little longer than that.
You have switched up your turkey game over the years. For a long time, you were the king of wrapping the whole thing in bacon.
Wrap the whole thing in bacon. And that was delicious.
It was delicious.
But
smoky and juicy.
The salt and pepper turkey, the salt and pepper bird with butter under the skin, and just filled with herbs.
Mm-hmm.
That is my now favorite thing.
Yeah, and you don't even have to like turn it upside down or any of that nope. crazy stuff. You make a moist turkey breast, and that is a kitchen miracle.
Yeah,
because those things always come out just you know
like I don't even like sawdust. I don't even like white meat, and the minute that bird comes out of the oven, that's what I want. I want yeah. that white meat because I know it's just soaked with butter. So. Yeah, that's all. That's the, and now you know, listeners, save your ideas, save it for next year if you haven't done yours this way, or if you don't care at all, then you fast forwarded to the movie talk anyways.
Right.
What are the I caught up on Edge of 17.
Yes.
Haley Steinfeld.
Right.
Is a young lady who is. Live-action Daria.
That's fair.
Yeah. In the grand tradition of Daria and Ghost World and you name the misanthropic teen.
Right.
This is who she is. She's rolling her eyes at her happy-go-lucky, high-achieving brother from a young age. He is played by Blake Jenner. Where's he from?
Everybody Wants Some.
And he's not a Jenner.
He's not a Jenner, no.
Okay.
And he was on Glee for the season that no one talks about.
So he's Jenner, but a whole different...
Yes.
Like, not related to Kylie, Kendall...
No.
Caitlin, none of that.
None of that.
All right. So, Keira Sedgwick is the mom. Woody Harrelson is the equally misanthropic teacher.
Yes. I knew you'd like him.
With whom she shares a love-hate relationship.
Right.
Like, she can't stop talking to him. She can't stop hanging out with him during his lunch breaks, where he's constantly telling her to get away from me. This is my lunch break. She has a best friend from childhood, played by Haley Lou Richardson. I've never seen her before. She has credits, but nothing I've ever looked at. So a couple of things happened to Haley Steinfeld's character. Her character's name is Nadine. Her very loving father has a heart attack and dies when she's 13. And so she spends the next several years really miserable and grieving. And the whole family actually spends that time kind of a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And she herself is a mess, Nadine is. She's a pain in the ass. You're rooting for her, but she's selfish and self-centered. She's funny and calls hypocrisy out when she sees it, but cannot see it in herself.
She's very Holden Caulfield that way.
Yeah. And she misreads people. All the time, the teacher,
mm-hmm.
her mother,
yes.
her brother, really, especially her brother. And so it's a film where she's the main character, but it's about all these people. And it's made by a first-time director, Kelly Freeman Craig,
mm-hmm.
who previously wrote Postgrad, which is not a good movie, and
no.
I assumed that it might have been a very good script that got completely taken out of her hands.
Distinctly possible. She did have James L. Brooks producing. It's interesting because he doesn't do a lot
right.
in the film realm anymore. But
right.
I was just this made me think about the fact that he's the one who stepped up and produced Say Anything,
yeah,
which got Cameron Crowe's career rolling.
Yeah.
So you know, who knows what it'll do for this gal.
So this movie is about a lot of things. It's about her identity crisis, her best friend begins dating her brother.
Right, which is like the ultimate so, betrayal.
Yeah, Nadine's older brother begins dating Nadine's best friend. What's the best friend's name? I'm looking it up right now. Krista.
Krista. So Nadine trying to figure out her nascent sexuality.
Yeah, she wants to have sex with a guy who ignores her.
Mm.
She chases him down, is incredibly provocative with him in terms of telling him what she wants. When the moment comes, she's like, no, no, no. And he's like, what is your problem?
I'm just going off what you said.
Yeah. And so it is so good. I heard very little about this before it was released.
Mm-hmm.
There was no buzz in any place from anyone
was,
that I heard
it,
of.
It was, well, you, as
no
you
one
like
I
to
heard
say,
anything
you,
from.
You live in your bubble.
Well, but I live in a bubble of marketing hype, but I ignore that. But when critics start talking
mm-hmm.
on film Twitter or to my actual face,
uh-huh.
then I listen to them. But I didn't hear any critics talking
well,
about this
movie. Well, this was the closing night film at Toronto this year.
Okay.
So it's they've been building it up.
Okay.
I've been hearing about it for a while.
All right.
Yeah, no, it's charming and it's funny and
it's smart. It's well balanced.
It's very compassionate towards all of its characters.
Yeah,
like you think it's going to be smart girl surrounded by a bunch of idiots,
right?
You know, which is how she sees it.
She sees them all as a bunch of idiots or betrayers.
Yeah,
and in fact, she's just
she's part of the problem.
She's kind of an a-hole.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hailee Steinfeld's performance in this film. Is like top 10 teen movie performances.
Yeah.
I will say that as I will declare that right now. If you are young, if you are older, it doesn't matter. Watch this film. Go buy a ticket because I don't think it's anyone's going to see it. I think it's kind of tanking, right?
It's too soon to say. I think it just opened. So
it did just open
yeah.
last Friday, but
yeah.
it's not...
It's,
doing all that well,
it's,
right?
It's kind of getting lost in the shuffle. It's like I think they're pitching it toward the critical class and less at teenagers. And teenagers, I think, would love this movie. I think it's like a really sharp John Hughes film.
Exactly. If you're a teenager who thinks everyone's a jerk, but you're willing to sort of like confront your own stuff.
Yep. There you go.
Here's a movie for you.
Yeah, I hope more people see it.
It is set in a decidedly middle class to upper middle class world.
Yes.
No one's hurting for anything.
Right.
No one is hurting for any kind of material needs. I mean, she has a guy who has a crush on her, who she finds out is secretly rich.
Yes.
And he just hasn't told her. And he's really funny.
And he's also a really interesting Asian character in a genre that has not served Asian characters that well.
Hayden Zito.
Hmm.
He's Canadian, and I've never seen him before, but he's funny and
like,
charming.
On What the Flick, Christie said that he's sort of like the revenge of Long Duck Dong.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, he's
oh,
like,
absolutely.
He's a
yeah.
much cooler character
yeah.
and a viable sort of
he's
romantic,
the, yeah.
You know, interest.
Which, and points for the movie for not even...
Bringing it up.
Bringing that up. Much like Moana, that we'll probably talk about this weekend after everyone's already seen it. And... Where was I going with this? I just completely lost my train of thought.
The rich guy.
Oh, she's supposed to be sort of middle class, but even she's got a pool in the backyard.
Like, wait, does she?
Yeah.
I thought it was a big deal when she goes over to his.
No, no, no. It is a big deal when she goes over to his because his is like a gigantic hot tub.
Oh, right. Okay.
It's a super. It's super heated, and it's the movie is set in the autumn, mm-hmm. and they're just dumping and jiving.
Mm.
They're jumping and diving into this
heated pool.
Completely heated pool where she says it's like a bathtub. So hers is apparently not like that. She has a poor person's backyard pool.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a while. It's terrific. I like this movie a lot. And Haley Steinfeld, she got an Oscar nomination for True Grit.
Yeah.
And then she will pop up in interesting places. Like, I enjoyed her in Begin Again. I think she's done some solid work. Apparently also a pop star in certain parts of the world.
In Europe right now. I think the songs that she's recorded might even be charting in the United States now, but I would have to go check on that. But I know that I have this weird thing with the European pop charts. I'm kind of obsessed with them, and so I just see her popping up.
I see.
On them. You know, this DJ featuring Hailee Steinfeld, like, she sings, and she's got hit singles in Europe.
All right.
Well, you know, she was in Pitch Perfect 2. She can sing.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And she's going to be in Pitch Perfect 3. I think she might be the lead in Pitch Perfect 3.
Okay.
That's my...
So this will break box office records in Benelux, then, is what we're saying.
What, Edge of 17?
Yes.
I don't know.
Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah.
But yeah, go see it.
It is... It's really good.
Yeah.
I know I sound surprised because there's already a movie called Edge of 17, and it's about a gay teenager. It came out like 15 years ago or whatever.
And more like 20.
More like 20 then? Okay, sure. Whenever it came out.
Well, maybe more like 50. I don't know. But yeah, you're right. We're still in Dallas.
And I thought, you couldn't even name your movie something that another movie hadn't already called itself. Like, I was a little irritated by that fact.
Yeah.
Thinking, what are you going to steal the gay movie's thunder now? Straight people. Always disappointing us.
Always borrowing from our culture.
Yeah.
Even though the title comes from Stevie Nicks.
Yeah. Yeah. Smart and lovely and moving, and I cannot recommend this highly enough.
Cool.
Although Gary Cotti, with whom I saw it, had a problem with the ending.
Did he?
Yeah. And it not the ending... But something that Kira Sedgwick does
when
when she's texting Hailee Steinfeld at the end of the movie. I won't tell you what the text is about.
She's texting with her whole face.
But she's texting in the way that Meg Ryan types on a computer in You've Got Mail. And it's distracting.
But we'll forgive that one thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What else did we see? Allied.
Or we're talking about that.
Let's talk about all things. We can hit it quickly and be done with it.
Sure.
Because it's not good.
No, it is not.
And I wish...
It is a World War II espionage romance. Brad Pitt plays a Canadian airman. And French spy Marion Cotillard pretend to be a married couple so they can assassinate a Nazi higher-up. And they do. And... she is so into the idea of playing a married couple with him that they eventually become one and have a baby together. And so they're settled in London, and then it turns out, dun dun dun, the higher-ups seem to think that she might be a German spy.
Right.
And so now Brad Pitt has to investigate her, and Brad Pitt has to lay a trap for her, and if it turns out she is one, he is expected to kill her. So at the same time, he's doing an investigation on the side to try and figure out if maybe she's not a spy, and this all sounds like it would be interesting.
Doesn't it sound exciting?
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds exciting. Like, I was fully invested for the first 20 minutes as they were in Casablanca, wearing amazing outfits, and... machine gunning Nazis. And I thought, I love Marion Cotillard machine gunning a Nazi. And then I thought, and now they're gonna kill Nazis with the power of smooching
and fashion.
And then it just turned into this boring slog with inert performances and a deadly sort of pace that should have been, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's make suspense and see what happens and find the spy and is she the one and is he crazy and
can he get the information?
Is someone double-crossing them? Right. Like, and none of that, none of that, none of that. Robert Zemeckis, what is his problem?
Somebody on Facebook said, "Is this any good? He hasn't made a good movie since Death Becomes
Correct.
Her." And that's true.
You know what one I like? I like that one with Michelle Pfeiffer.
Oh, come on. What Lies Beneath?
Yeah, that's the name.
You just like it when she goes, "Forbidden Fruit."
Yeah, like, that's... I was reminded of Michelle Pfeiffer's "Forbidden Fruit" line in What Lies Beneath, which is terrible, but I completely enjoy it. I was reminded of that moment when Marion Cotillard is shown giving birth during a bombing raid outside. Like, bombs are dropping all over the place, blowing everything up, and she's like, I'm in labor and I'm having a baby outside. And
mind you, the same kid was conceived in the front seat of a car during a violent sandstorm.
Right.
They're so passionate that the winds have whipped up around them.
That was funny. Like, the part where you're supposed to be scared that she's going to get blown up during childbirth. You know she's not going to get blown up during childbirth or the movie's over.
Right.
And so the fact that it just happens during this raid where London is being destroyed.
During the Blitz.
And she's out on a gurney on the sidewalk giving birth.
Surrounded by nuns.
Yeah. That was funny.
We talked about how it has one of the worst ADRs I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, God. There's this moment where Marion Cotillard and Brad Pitt go off to bone, but they tell the babysitter, "We're going to go pick mushrooms for stroganoff."
Well, they do both.
They pick the mushrooms, then they bone, then they come back. So then here comes the party where she's serving the stroganoff. You have forgotten about this little incidental bit of information that a stroganoff had any reason to be talked about more than once.
Yeah, but now Brad Pitt is trying to figure out if she's a spy or not, and the house is full of guests, and she may be starting to get suspicious that he is suspicious, and they have this conversation, and it's very terse and elliptical, and they kind of stare at each other, and then she walks off, and you get the impression that they looked at it and thought, there needs to be some reason why she walks off. Oh, I know, let's loop in this line, and you hear somebody off screen say, "Something's burning. I think it's the stroganoff." Thanks, movie. Brad Pitt is not interested in being a conventional leading man.
No.
And this movie demands a conventional leading man.
And she's not interested in being.
And ditto, same for her. You know, but this movie wants to be this sort of like sweeping, old-fashioned, old Hollywood kind of romance. So you
kind of need... The fact that they're both gorgeous is not...
Enough. You need people who are willing to be sort of square-jawed, larger-than-life movie star types and not... The kind of actors
interior work sort of actors, and that's exactly what she is.
Yeah,
she didn't win that Academy Award for being, you know, glamorous.
Well, I do not love the role that she won the Academy Award for. Had she won for 2 Days, 1 Night, however, I would be completely
Be amazing because that movie is incredible and she is great in it.
Yeah, and she's giving a completely opposite kind of performance.
Right. So, I. Did enjoy this film on one level. Outfits.
Yes. Joanna Johnston was the costume designer. She's done a lot of Zemeckis and Spielberg movies, including War Horse.
You know I love War Horse. Because at the end, War Horse comes back.
To the boy,
and they're so happy.
She also did the she did the costumes for The Man from U.N.C.L.E. The movie.
Oh, that great. All those great
everybody
costumes.
Everybody looked amazing in.
All those great costumes in Man from U.N.C.L.E. Marion Cotillard changes outfits as many times as Blake Lively does in Age of Adeline.
She's basically like...
And if you saw Age of Adeline, and outfit fans, you should see Age of Adeline.
Yes.
Go see this, because this is outfit heaven.
She's like one of those Braniff stewardesses of the early 70s where she's like just constantly switching outfits while she's talking and doing other things.
There are so many scenes of her walking to and from the camera in an outfit. Mm. And you're looking at her thinking, wow, I wish this was just the whole movie.
Who is she the face of?
Lancôme?
Lancôme,
Dior, Chanel, who cares?
Somebody. France. She's the face of France.
She's the also the face of forehead tétés.
That's true. One of the best Funny or Die segments ever, if you've never seen it. Marion Cotillard for forehead details.
Okay, we're not going to do DVDs because we are at the 30-minute mark
and you're gonna, we're
of
gonna
our halvesies episode.
We're going to talk about L this weekend on the next show. And
I will have seen L by the time we do.
And best worst thing that ever could have happened.
Yes. We got some letters, though. Let's do some letters.
Okay.
We got like a 10 or so.
I sent you a bunch. And again, these aren't all the letters, but they will get us a good way towards
We're still
being
catching
done.
Up.
We're up to like early October now. I think if we can get through all of these.
I'm reading the first one. I'm too embarrassed to read this.
In a nutshell, someone wants to turn...
No. Don't even say it. It's from Wilson.
He knows what he said.
He knows what he said. It's not that I'm uncomfortable reading it. It's not that it's too naughty or anything, but... Here's the thing. I've been doing shtick for years with you about, like, oh, I'm so great and this and that, you know.
But actual compliments make you uncomfortable.
Yeah. So this is an actual compliment that makes me uncomfortable. Well, it doesn't make me uncomfortable personally. I soaked that up.
You just don't want to read it.
Personally, I just don't want to read it out loud. Yeah. This is from Samantha. First time emailer is the subject line. Dear David Alonso, I have been listening to your podcast for several months now. This is from September, and I haven't introduced myself. So after listening to several emails that have been inspired to do just that, I'm Sam and I'm 16 from the often cold Midwest. Lucky. I found out about your podcast through What the Flick, mostly due to my pure joy in Alonzo's rage about certain films like Cars 2. When I found that Dave had additional complimentary rage about films, my heart soared. God smiled, fairies were born, it was a good day. Through your podcast and What the Flick, you guys have inspired me to take film classes at my high school.
Oh, cool.
And convinced my friends that I've gone absolutely insane. I've always been really interested in the Christian movie reviews, as I am known around these here parts as the super Catholic, who goes to the giant hippie church and loves Jesus, and while all that's true, I really love hearing your opinions about them. It's good to know what people outside of the faith think about these movies. Here's what we think about them. They're mostly trash, and the people who make them should be ashamed. It's good to know what people outside the faith think about these movies, and for a lot of them, I find myself agreeing with you guys. They usually are badly made, poorly written, and pathetically artistic. Don't get me started on Heaven is for Real. So when Dave said he didn't actually hate Hillsong, Let Hope Rise, I got so excited I couldn't take it. I just kept thinking, we accomplished something. Dave and Alonzo don't totally hate our movies. On behalf of the Christian community, thank you for your reviews on our movies. That keeps us humble and informed, and thank you for not hating that movie. You were both lights in my life, and if I ever come to LA, I would totally love to meet up and have coffee and talk about life. Sure.
You got it.
Since I do not have a car, and the only place I would be going in the near future is Ohio, that will not happen soon, but a girl can dream. Chances are I'll probably email you again, because I'm bursting with thoughts all the time, so until next time, goodbye you guys. Sincerely, Sam. P.S. In Los Angeles, do you think that the Midwest is basically Canada? Because apparently people in Kansas sincerely believe this to be true, and now I'm very concerned for the whole of America. I do not think of the Midwest as Canada, because I am from the middle of the country myself, the southern middle of the country, New Mexico and Texas. And
I think when the Midwest is being nice, we think of it as an offshoot of Scandinavia, and that's Garrison Keillor's fault.
Yes.
And when the Midwest is being mean, we think of it as the Southeast.
Yes. Perfect. That is a perfect. Yeah. As for the Christian movies, I don't know how much I've addressed this in versus, you know, the amount of episodes you've listened to, but just in case you're hearing this for the first time, I grew up evangelical.
Yes.
Like, this was my life until my early 20s. And then, you know, being queer and punk rock, that's... I'm making a knife to the throat gesture right now. And that's, you know, that's the evangelical community's fault that kind of thing happens to people.
You are coming to these movies from an informed place.
I know the language. I know that world. I know it inside and out.
Mm-hmm.
So, Art House Day. This is from Craig.
There was a thing called Art House Day this year, and we asked people what went down at your art house, because we didn't go.
Yeah. I'm not sure how Art House Day went for other theaters, but for my friend Logan's theater, the Frida, F-R-I-D-A, cinema located behind the Orange Curtain in historic downtown Santa Ana, California, Art House Day was a resounding success. The Frida does have the benefit of having two screens, so that one can be showing the normal movie of the week, currently White Girl. Did we get a screener of White Girl? We did, right? Finally? An end-of-the-year awards screener of White Girl?
Maybe. We have a large stack now. I don't know.
And the other screen is used for special stuff. As far as programming, Logan made a weekend of the whole thing by doing a Friday night double feature of Willy Wonka and Blazing Saddles, followed by an 11 p.m. screening of Videodrome. Art House Day proper featured Time Bandits in the morning for families, the new restoration of Phantasm in the evening for grown-ups, and a midnight screening of The Room for the cultists, so something for everyone. The Frida is a non-profit and just shy of 2 years old. An event like Art House Day is a great way to get people's attention. Things were pretty dire in the early months of the theater, but gradually they have built up a little following, which has allowed them to get new screens, a new marquee, and they are currently working on more comfortable seating. We should go there sometime.
I know. I've heard about events there, and I just haven't.
I mean, it's a million miles away from where we are, but, you know. So while I get Dave's reservations about being crammed into a theater full of annoying people, for a struggling art house, an event like this can bring some very well-needed, very much-needed attention. Next time you guys are in Orange County, I highly recommend dropping in on the Frida. There's a lot of great restaurants in the area, too. I was just thinking, I'd love to go there as long as I can go to Portillo's after we're done. Get one of those.
Way to park. Mm.
Get one of the
deep dipped
sandwiches and the cake shake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Salad with the noodly things in
can
it.
I get knifed, too?
Oh, okay.
I am leaving out Pulp Fiction because I know Alonzo will nix that one. Ed Wood.
Yeah.
Dr. Strangelove.
Mm-hmm.
Taxi Driver.
Sure.
L.A. Confidential.
Yeah.
Buffalo 66.
Yeah, I've still never seen it.
It's
you like
real
it, right?
Good. Yeah. Okay, yeah. You know I love that Vincent Gallo.
Mm-hmm.
I love the Brown Bunny.
Yes, I know.
The Godfather Part 2.
Okay.
Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
Annie Hall.
Yeah.
Chasing Amy.
Yeah.
Y tu mamá también.
Sure.
100% knife, Craig.
Totally.
That's what you are. For now.
You were on the razor's edge with some of those choices, but I'll let them go.
This is from John in Seattle. Hey, Alonzo and Dave, I heard about your podcast when Chris Lavoie said, I love those guys on the Stephanie Miller show. I thought that was a pretty good endorsement. So after trying to remember the name of the thing and hitting a few blind alleys, such as Putty Knife, I started listening about 4 months ago. Again, this letter is from September. I recently listened to the episode in which Dave said he was laboriously downloading all of his reviews from movies.com one at a time. This is the guy that put everything in the zip file.
Yes.
That's the end of the letter. He put everything in a zip file. John, you're incredible.
You're a
Thank
saint
you.
Among men.
Some questions from, as the message loads up. This is from Julian.
Okay.
I first sent the following email to you the week before your 5th anniversary episode about a year ago, but because of backlog, it didn't get read in time. I have sent it a few times since then, but I guess it always slips through the cracks. I didn't want to keep resetting it too many, as I have been called out in the past for inelegantly doing that. I promise I won't resend after this time. Dear Mr. Duralde and Mr. White, it's Julian from the Cinema Touch.
The Cheese Touch.
I haven't written in a while, but I'm still listening to every episode, as I have since late 2010. That's a long time, listener.
Yeah, that's from,
Thank you,
from
Julian.
The get-go.
If I had to pick a favorite moment from your 5 years, it would be the beginning of the Great Gatsby episode when the candle fell on the plate just as the tape player stopped. I was just wondering, what are your quick, rapid opinions on the following films? The Iron Giant.
Love it.
Yeah, I do love it. underrated, underseen, underloved.
Indeed.
Michael Clayton. I remember really liking Michael Clayton at the time.
Of all the current movies that have tried to cop a 70s vibe,
yep,
it does it better than most. And Tilda Swinton is great in that movie.
Oh, yeah. All sweaty and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was my favorite bit.
The little dress flappy thing.
My favorite bit was her being sweaty. Mm. Yeah. In the Mood for Love.
Oh, gorgeous.
Yeah. I don't think there's a minute of In the Mood for Love that isn't the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's a movie for movie lovers, no question. It's just it's so sensual
and so it is moving, and it's heartbreaking, mm, and it makes you want to be in that kind of love, even if you're already in love. Mm-hmm. Like, it makes you feel bad about your boring love.
You're doing it wrong.
Like, you should be dressing better for your love, you know.
And if you're a fan of that movie, you should totally pick up our friend John Powers' book about Wong Kar-wai that they came on to talk about this year.
Yes, yes, yes. It
makes a great gift.
It is staggeringly beautiful, and just I cannot praise it highly enough.
Absolutely. It was on my top 10 of the first decade.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Great. I've still never read the book.
I believe that I have talked about this before, but it was a while ago, and if you're not a long-time listener, maybe you don't know, didn't hear it. It was not the very first R-rated film I ever saw.
It was my first R-rated film.
It was the second R-rated film I ever saw. But the first R-rated movie I saw was a terrible, like, booby comedy that my dad took me to see. I was 12. And this was the serious movie. Like, this was the grown-up movie that I got to see. Like, when I saw the booby movie, it was called Undercover Zero, and it starred Peter Sellers playing multiple roles. Terrible, terrible film. And I knew it. Like, I knew it. And I was watching the boobies thinking, look at that. Ladies.
Those are boobies.
Those naked ladies. Like, I'd already seen naked ladies in my dad's Playboy.
Mm-hmm.
But these were naked ladies, and they were running around, bouncing around.
They were moving.
Their boobies were jumping. Yeah. So, seeing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest made me feel like a grown-up. Made me feel like an adult.
Yeah, I remember, I don't really know.
Because I got it. I understood it.
I don't even know why they took me. Like, it was just one of those random things where, like, they couldn't get a sitter or something. And I just went with my mom and, like, my sisters. And I remember they covered my eyes a couple of times. But, yeah, for the most part, I was like, oh, I'm in on something here that's over my head. Yeah. I'm mostly following what's happening.
Here's the weird thing. I haven't seen it since that night. I've only seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest once. I have not revisited the film as an adult.
Should.
I know I should. I assume, you know, the New Beverly or Egyptian will get around to showing it sometime, and I'll go again.
It's a movie that it kind of wears its metaphors on its sleeve, but the performances are also good that you don't mind.
Also, one more question. Do either of you know why Ms. Dargis finally decided to join Twitter? If the reason is a personal one that you feel uncomfortable sharing of your own volition, then I understand. I don't know why.
I have no idea.
I don't know. I'm just happy she did.
Yeah.
She's great at Twittering.
Mm-hmm.
I love Manola, and B, I love her on Twitter. She does it well.
Yes. And actually, lately she's been getting very informative, like on Facebook anyway. She'll talk about, like...
Yeah, you should follow her on Facebook, too.
Check out these musicals, or here's this Paul Newman-directed short that TCM is about to air that was just discovered.
Yeah.
You know, like, stuff I didn't know about.
This is from Rob. Hi, Dave and Alonzo. In response to your discussion on The Dressmaker... Mm. And Australian cinema in general, here are some observations I've made having grown up here. While I don't pretend to be an expert or representative of Australia as a whole, the broad sense of humor you alluded to didn't feel overly excessive to me. Hmm. So much of Australian humor and identity on screen usually derives from an underdog working class image that is projected in media. Considering our origins as a colony for British convicts, there was a 40,000-year indigenous history before 1776. That is a whole different issue. The way in which Australians portray themselves tend to focus on values of mateship, a fair go for all, and the hard-working battler. These traits are best personified in the 1997 film The Castle, and for me at least, it's the best example of how Australians like to see themselves, at least in a white middle-class sense. A film like The Castle has an Australian-ness to it that I imagine wouldn't translate all that well to international audiences, whereas I feel The Dressmaker could be set anywhere remote. It just happens to take place in Australia.
Did I ever tell you, I used to watch The Paul Hogan Show? Like before Crocodile Dundee, he had like a sketch comedy show. And one of the PBS stations in Atlanta used to run it. And so for years, I saw these like goofy sketch comedy things. And he would do these very kind of like blokey, you know, always wearing the footy shorts, you know, and, right. and characters and yeah. stuff. And then when like Crocodile Dundee, I was like, oh, that guy.
Oh, him. I know his
I've
work.
Enjoyed his work for years.
He continues, this sense of Australian identity is probably why Russell Crowe's The Water Diviner was received much better here than overseas. I know Dave was highly critical of The Water Diviner for its revisionist history of omitting the Armenian Genocide, but from personal experience of growing up studying World War I in high school history, the focus has always been exclusively on Australia and Gallipoli. I'm not saying that the film gets a pass for excluding the details, but that film was made for Australians. And by and large, most people, including myself, had never heard of the Armenian Genocide before it was raised in relation to the film. To put into context, April 25th, the day the Anzacs landed at Gallipoli, is a national holiday held in high regard from my schooling and how the media portrays the event. The focus is always on the Australian aspect.
Well, I'm glad that you're now having that conversation then, if it yeah. took this movie to make it happen.
I've probably oversimplified it, but for me at least, Australian films that take place in or about Australia and don't feature flame-throwing guitars are made first and foremost for Australians. The vast majority of Australian films don't make their budgets back and rely on government funding. The local audience has to be catered to at the expense of international markets. Hopefully this helps to inform you somewhat on Australian cinema. I would make a huge recommendation of Predestination, a sci-fi film starring Ethan Hawke,
oh, yeah.
Noah Taylor, and a brilliant performance from Sarah Snook, who was in The Dressmaker. If you haven't seen it yet, I can't recommend it highly enough. Regards, Rob.
I've heard very good things about that movie. I need to check it out. And I would recommend it for people who are interested in a certain aspect of Australian film history, a movie called Not Quite Hollywood, which is about Ozploitation cinema.
Yeah.
It's very entertaining.
Yeah. Here's another one from not another one. Similar name. This is from Julius.
Oh, okay.
Of the Solute. Mm-hmm. And he's written us before.
Yes.
Up here in Seattle, several of our art houses had special screenings for Art House Day. The SIFF's Uptown Theater showed a 4K remaster of Phantasm.
That's the Seattle International Film Festival.
And director Don Coscarelli doing a Skype before and after. The Grand Illusion Cinema showed a digital print of Time Bandits. Oh, so these were making the rounds.
Apparently so, yeah.
And giving out a reproduction of the Time Map. Hmm. Northwest Film Forum was running its local sightings film festival, featuring a bunch of Pacific Northwest produced films, many of which might not get any distribution, so there was a lot of unusual choices for us. I went to the Grand Illusion the night before to celebrate their made-up Grindhouse Theater Day. I love that. With a screening of I Drink Your Blood, which I love.
Nobody showed Singles?
You've just offended every single person
they know I'm
who
kidding.
Listens in Seattle.
They know I'm kidding. And don't leave out Tacoma.
I Drink Your Blood, one of my favorite horror films, he's talking about. right now. It is, in his words, a 70s Herschel Gordon Lewis-esque horror movie, horror in quotes, about a murderous, satanic hippie cult who get infected with a strain of rabies that mixes with the hardcore drugs they take to become super rabies. Violence and mayhem ensue. It is not a good movie in the traditional sense, but it is a riot.
There's a new DVD release of that that comes with its own syringe.
Yeah. And it has an incredible, wild electronic score. I'm not reading the letter right now. But he continues, any movie that opens with naked, muscular hippies dropping acid while proclaiming that Satan was the original acid head gets a second look in my book. I agree. I adore this film.
Joe Bob Briggs used to always refer to I Drink Your Blood and I Eat Your Flesh as the Catholic double feature.
One more plug. I think Dave would love Demon, a Polish horror film about national identity and buried trauma set at a wedding. I think it was one of those New York, Los Angeles releases, but it deserves a bit more love from the art house crowd. Thank you for years of listening. I love listening to the banter. You mean the clap trap and the chit chat? Yeah. Here's another letter about Art House Day. This is from Christopher.
Well, we asked.
Good tidings, amigos. Jacksonville's independent movie theater, Sunray Cinema, participated in Art House Theater Day by screening Time Bandits.
Okay, then.
Now all y'all know that you ain't special. Everybody who had Time Bandits on the same day. It was playing at the same time as 2001. A Space Odyssey in their other screening room, and I had already bought a pass for their Kubrick retrospective. I overheard several parents in line for concessions describing the movie to their children and how it was a big deal when they were themselves children. The theater was also giving away replicas of the Supreme Being's map for the kids. If you find, gentlemen, or any listeners, ever find yourself in the bold new city of the South, is that what...
Is that
what they call Jacksonville?
Or Jacksonville?
The bold new city of the South?
maybe they call themselves that. I don't know.
I highly recommend. I think it's a good name. I think that's a cool name to get. Look, hey, everybody. Guess what we are? We're the bold new city of the South.
Because
we just made that up because we say. I highly recommend visiting Sunray. They typically screen an eclectic mix of films, new and old, and also make a mean hot dog. No, I like a mean hot dog.
Yeah.
It's the best time you can have in this city if you're not into mediocre beaches or terrible football. Stay gold, pony men. If you open this email, there will be a picture of a bunny.
That's the header.
This is from Eleanor. Oh, look, there's a picture of a bunny with a backpack. The bunny's wearing a tiny little bunny backpack.
No.
Hey, Devin Alonso. My name is Eleanor. I'm 19, and I am from New Zealand.
Whoa.
I first heard about your podcast from my friend Jesse, who you may or may not remember wrote a letter to you last year. He was the gay one who really liked Wall-E and the 2011 Winnie the Pooh. So did we.
Mm-hmm.
He got me hooked, and from there I went to the B-Movies podcast, to a whole bunch of other film, television, and writing podcasts. I've debated whether or not to write in before, but unfortunately for me I can be a bit shy, so I haven't had the courage until now to send a letter. You recently touched upon terrible theater-going experiences, and I'm afraid to say that I just had one that almost made me leave the theater in tears. Oh no! Up until now, it's only really been the usual phone screens, text or call notifications, or people, namely children, who laugh a bit too loudly or too long that really bothers me. The last time I got annoyed was when watching Kubo and the Two Strings. Generally, when I watch movies, I check reviews of them, usually yours, to see if there's anything in it worth spending my money on, and then I watch a trailer to see if it's actually of interest to me. And thanks to the speed, if any, at which New Zealand imports movies to show in theaters, it's usually been so long since I've seen the trailer that I completely forget what happens, so I go into the theaters the way I want to, with no idea what on earth is about to happen. Unfortunately, with Kubo, I got stuck waiting for the movie to start, sitting behind a family of six.
Oof.
The youngest was about 4 and didn't seem to have any idea why they were there. I think he thought they were there to watch The Secret Life of Pets. So his mom took out her tablet and showed him the trailer for Kubo. I tried to look away, but the screen was shining light right in front of me, and the volume was so loud that I ended up watching the trailer for the movie I wanted to see while sitting in the theater for it. But what I'm really writing about was my experience yesterday. When I went with the aforementioned Jesse to see Don't Breathe, I was super excited to see it, and overall I really did like it, but something happened that both infuriated and frightened me. It's a bit hard to describe without giving away the plot. Oh, I know where she's going. Mm. But basically towards the end, it gets a little bit rapey. Mm. There's no actual sexual contact or nudity, but if the man tries to violate the woman in a way, that is pretty much rape, and the dude admits that he's done it to another woman before. If you factor in all the trauma that the characters have been through up until now and the way that she reacts to this attempted rape and what it will mean for her, it's horrifying. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It is.
It's intense. And the movie knows that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, here we go. I certainly wasn't expecting it to go there, but it was definitely a very intense moment that had me on the edge of my seat. What I also wasn't expecting was that a grown-ass adult male would laugh at her attempted rape. It wasn't even a laugh, more like a guffaw, and it was loud, loud enough to be heard clearly from the other side of the theater a few rows down. I had no idea what to think or do. I just kind of sat there looking away from the screen. This wasn't a laugh made because it was an uncomfortable situation. If he felt that way, he would have been like the few groups of people who sat in front of me who quietly murmured in each other's ears and shifted in their seats. I remember the press screening and people going, oh, like in unison. And the laugh came when she got her revenge.
Right.
Yeah. I think a woman sitting a few seats away from me was actually really affected by me. This guy legitimately found the whole sequence entertaining. Anyway, this woman, just judging by the way her boyfriend had his arm around her, and they were talking quite seriously before they got up and left after the film finished. Okay. I left the whole ordeal feeling not only afraid that this man is now going out into the world and interacting with real people, but I started getting mad again. You know, sometimes you see so much crap in the news that's sexist and racist and homophobic that you get really angry and there's nothing you can do about it, so the anger slowly starts to build up as you hear more and more stuff and it starts to exhaust you, and one day you know you're going to snap and have a breakdown? Yes. I live in the United States. We just elected a sociopath to become our president. I started feeling the breakdown moment creeping up again. So I would like to make a request of you two, if you don't mind. You know how sometimes you say, Dave, that you don't know why more, insert demographic here, aren't burning down more theaters or rioting in the streets? Well, I honestly want nothing more sometimes than to punch a dude in the face and blow stuff up, but I know that if we were to do something like that it would probably cause more harm than good. So I would like to ask for recommendations of movies where other women punch dudes in the face and blow things up. I want to see women stealing and fighting and straight up murdering people. I want to see women who embrace anger and chaos and just destroy a whole bunch of men. Not even that. Considering how little female-led action movies there are, I just want to see women manipulating or outsmarting people or just taking control of the events in their lives. From Kill Bill to Far From Heaven, I'd please just like a little something that can remind me that there is hope for ladies out there. Thank you for all the effort you guys put into this wonderful podcast. I feel like I've learned so much from your criticism and know that it will definitely influence my decisions later in life when I become a director of animation and make my own movies.
All right.
Yours sincerely, Eleanor.
The Last Seduction.
There is a French film. From 2000.
Baise-moi?
Called Baise-moi. Do I recommend it?
I was trying to think, do I recommend Ms. 45?
Baise-moi is a film that has real sex in it. The actors are really having sex. And when I say sex, I mean assaults and rape. The actors on screen are engaging sexually, and the plot is that they are raping and being assaulted. And then the two women, who are the protagonists, they go on a a murderous rampage.
That's kind of the plot of Ms. 45.
That is also the plot of A Spit on Your Grave.
Yes.
The original A Spit on Your Grave, which is also harrowing.
Yes.
But it does involve a woman taking revenge and slaughtering the men who have harmed her.
That is also the plot of Hanny Calder with Raquel Welch.
Yeah.
That is also the plot of the remake of I Spit on Your Grave. Are there female action movies
that are not about revenge
after rape? Well, that's The Last Seduction.
Right.
It's somewhat of an action movie. It's more that Linda Fiorentino is just outsmarting everyone.
Right.
And conning everyone.
Right.
But she's great, and the movie's great.
I'd have to think on this more. Because off the top of my head, it was all revenge movies.
Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill.
Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill. Totally.
Yeah. That has the very first, like, male-female, mano-a-mano, like, physical karate fight.
Yeah.
And Tura Satana more than holds her own.
Listen, go back in time and watch like some old Barbara Stanwyck movie or
ooh, Johnny Guitar.
Ida Lupino movie or old Betty Davis movie, and if they weren't in control, they were in control of themselves.
Yeah.
And they were they're gods. They're screen gods, these women.
As the Australian filmmaker Gillian Armstrong told me this year, when I interviewed her for our website, linoleum-knife.com, we talked about her documentary about Ori Kelly, and she said going back and revisiting the old Warner Brothers movies with Betty Davis, she realized like how ahead of their time they were. Like she said that, you know, when she was making Mrs. Sofel, which is a true story about a woman who helps a murderer escape from prison, you know, and the studio notes were like, well, does she have to be a murderer? You know, and the letter opens with Betty Davis, like, shooting her adulterous lover, you know, like, several times.
The Pam Grier films of the early 70s?
Oh, yeah, totally. Coffee and...
Yeah. Any of those.
Yeah. Sheba Baby?
Yeah. So anyway, we'll think of some more.
What's the Soderbergh movie with Gina Carano? Haywire.
Oh, Haywire is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some out there.
This is from Dustin. Dear David Alonzo, I'm writing in to share my story of how I stumbled across your podcast. I believe it's amusing and figured you might get a chuckle out of it as well. I wrote in back in April when you first asked new listeners to write in. But I'm afraid the internet devoured my previous letter. It might have.
Oops.
Now, to preface this story, I figured I should share a little background about myself. I'm originally from a small town of about 6,000 people, smack dab in the middle of North Carolina, 100 miles away from the nearest city. Needless to say, it is a hellhole. A year and a half ago, I moved across the country to Spokane to live with my then-girlfriend, now-wife. This past Christmas, we flew back to my hometown for a week to spend the holidays with my family. During this visit, I was scrolling through Instagram one evening when I came across a picture of Alonzo and thought to myself, hey, it's Alonzo Duralde. I like him on What the Flick, so I should follow him on Instagram. So I followed the account. After a few minutes, I get a notification that Linoleum Cast started following me, and to be honest, I freaked out. I burst into the kitchen and exclaimed with joy to an audience of confused faces that a film critic that I admire started following me. They responded with mostly cool and awesome because they didn't know who or what I was talking about. Growing up there, the closest movie theater was a 45-minute drive away, and I was the only person in my family who made the trek at least once a week to see whatever we had playing. Like Dave, I had no art house cinemas, so I'm just now starting to be able to expand my film knowledge, and I love reading and writing about it. I explained to them who Alonzo was, and after I started thinking to myself, wait a second, Linoleum Cast sounds an awful lot like the name of a show, so I searched the name of the podcast in iTunes, and lo and behold, a new addiction was born. Thanks to the simple act of one of you touching a button, I was introduced to a whole new world of phenomenal movie podcasts and conversations. I enjoy every episode of Linoleum Knife. I find myself connecting with Dave quite a bit, and honestly, you two are both wonderful human beings. A lot has happened in my life since I found Linoleum Knife, and y'all have been there with me through every bit of it. Anyway, I just wanted to take a minute and send a thank you your way for being my go-to podcast for the last 10 months. I enjoy every second of every show, and hopefully someday soon I can join your club. Next time, I will include a list for you to knife, so keep on knifing, fellas. Sincerely, Dustin.
Well, thanks, Dustin.
That's and that's the cool. end. We are done.
All right. It's a halfway episode. Insert all the things I would normally say here at the end of the show, but I will say thank you, Blue, for our theme music, because that's always so great. And join our club at patreon.com/linoleumknife. We do still have some old school white lettering on black shirt linoleum knife t-shirts left. You can PayPal us $22.
$22
at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. More if it's outside of the U.S. And if you have a size you think we might be running out of, email us first and double check.
That would be 2XL men.
Or do we still have them?
Men are size and shape.
At this particular moment,
I think we might have like one or two left.
Okay, so act fast.
But ask me before you send money.
Yes. Anyway, check back with us this weekend. We'll be doing a full-on episode with tons and tons of new movies opening for the holidays, minus Allied, which we've already gotten off our plate. Y'all are great, and we will catch you soon. Have a great Thanksgiving, whatever it is you do. And I guess if you're in the U.S., the rest of you don't know what the hell that is or don't care. But we'll be back in a few days.
Goodbye.